thatgreatbusinessshow.com is brought to you by DeFacto Shaving Oil, the best anyone can get. Made in Ireland, sold worldwide.
Welcome to thatgreatbusinessshow.com. I am your host, Conall O'Moran. Please follow me on Twitter, where I'm known as @ConallOM. This is episode Winnie the Pooh. That rhymes with episode 42. We are Ireland's best business podcast, and we're posting this on the 9th of July, 2021. On episode 42, we have a family entrepreneur from Kildare who is naturally mad keen to talk about his international family businesses and paint. Lots and lots of paint. We have a Cork-based marketing company that also has developed a software that keeps an eye on repairs to Garda cars. And that's what I call a diverse business. And I've heard enough, maybe too much guff, and that's the polite word for it, about the future of the office. Will they? Won't they? Will they be used again? So I decided to get the real story from someone whose business depends on designing future offices. But before we start, a quick word from our sponsor. If you're finally going on holidays, don't bother bringing a big, bulky, polluting shaving foam can. For just €13, you can have the world's best shaving oil, DeFacto Shaving Oil, in your wash bag. Their nail varnish size bottle will last more than half a year of daily shaving, so it's buy two and keep one for when you travel.
That's great business show.
We had some great feedback to the podcast during the week, including a LinkedIn message from Aisling Finn, founder of Waterford-based The Book Resort. Aisling wrote to me, "Hi Conall, I have listened to a few of your podcasts and I had number 31 playing, the one with the lads from FM 104. I was driving down the motorway when the podcast started. Needless to say, I was howling with laughter and tears were falling. Just reaching out to say thank you for the best laugh in a long time and for introducing me to Jim and Nobby. Kind regards, Aisling." Well, thanks, Aisling, and thanks again to Jim and Nobby. If you need a really, really good belly laugh, give episode 31 a listen. I must have listened to it 20 times and I still love it. And please, please do get in touch. We read everything you send us and we respond to as much as possible. The best way to get us, as Aisling did, is to join our LinkedIn page where we post more about the show and where we hope to have some really big news coming up in the next couple of weeks. And I am often asked how people can have their businesses featured on Ireland's Best Business Podcast, and my answer is always the same. Get in touch with us. But I'm always on the hunt for interesting businesses that I come across in the ordinary course of the week as well. For example, I needed some paint for the house recently, and naturally, I opted for Irish-made paint. And that is how I ended up in the architecturally beautiful HQ of Selbridge Kildare-based Colour Trend, where I got really top-class service, despite the place being absolutely humming. And that made me go and find out more about the business, and that's why I'm delighted to welcome the chairman of Colour Trend, or the General Paints Group, as they are more correctly called, Kevin O'Connor, to join me on That Great Business Show. Kevin, you are so welcome.
Conall, thank you very much, and thanks for a lovely introduction.
Well, it's just well deserved. I went down there, the place was absolutely hopping. You had two women on the floor. They couldn't have been nicer. They couldn't have been more calm. I saw one of them answering a phone while she was dealing with me. Got a phone number, saw her phoning the customer back. Really, really top class service. So somebody is teaching them well.
Yeah, well, that would be our, we have 7 retail shops as part of our group. And we concentrate a lot on trying to be leading, the leading light in terms of what's best for paint retailing. We get a lot of our ideas from abroad. I don't think we've had many original ideas ourselves, but we're great at stealing ideas.
Few people have original ideas, yeah, but yeah. It's adapting and adapting or adapting and adapting is the key, isn't it? Now, I know I'm not allowed to mention them, but there are other brands available out there, the Duluxes and the Fleetwoods and all of those ones.
Yeah, there are. I mean, we would see ourselves with 5 competitor brands in the market, and they're all part of very large multinational groups. So multi-billion dollar companies. And it did put it up to us early on that for us to survive against these very strong companies, we would have to be very strong ourselves. So I concentrated on things like governance of the business and building a strong management team and things like that very early on. Strategic planning being another thing.
You're very, very keen on family business governorship and about the whole education around them, because you're involved with the DCU family business unit, or what is it called?
It's called the National Centre for Family Business at DCU.
I knew it was a fancy name, yeah. Okay.
Oh yeah, they just got the national title recently, so we're very, very proud of that.
And you are on the board there?
There's an advisory board to the centre, and I'm part of it as one of the family members on the board, yeah.
So let us wheel back a little bit to the 1950s. Your dad, he was in the States.
My dad qualified from UCD, like yourself, as a chemical engineer in 1950. And like many people at that time, there was no jobs in Ireland. So he emigrated out to the US. He had an auntie in San Francisco. So he went to San Francisco and he just happened to get a job in the paint industry. After being there for a few years, I think it was 1952 or 53, he'd moved up from being a lab manager to being general manager. And they wanted to open a branch in Mexico. And he thought, if I'm going to go to Mexico, why wouldn't I go home to Ireland and start my own company?
That was a really kind of big thought for him.
It was. And we often talked about that. Unfortunately, he's gone now. And I'd love to learn more about that at the time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But he was very entrepreneurial and he was very determined. And at the time, it was not a good time to start a business in Ireland. It was very poor times.
This is pre-Lamass as well. So
it was
bleak, bleak, bleak time.
Yeah, but he had the personality and he had the determination. I think he had the sticking power, which was required because, you know, the business was very small and stayed very small for a long number of years.
Until Kevin got involved.
Well, by the time I got involved, we were about €1 million in turnover. So,
which back then was okay, wasn't it?
That was good. Back in 1983, yeah. But yeah, we worked together for a couple of years and he was tired and he was keen to retire and go off and do other things, which he did. And that's when I took over.
Did you have any rows?
We did, but I actually had a great way of getting around my dad. If I wanted to do A and my dad wanted to do B, we would have a conversation and I learned to say to my dad, you know, I think we should do B. And then he'd say, no, it should be A. And he'd get his way, but I would as well.
That sounds a sensible way to do it. So you take over in 83, is it?
In 83, yeah.
But since then, you have built and built and built a very big business.
Yeah, we've grown. We had, I think, 10 employees in 1983 and we've 140 today. So it's been a tremendous journey. I mean, I've just enjoyed every minute of it. And I don't really feel like I had a working life running a business. I just enjoyed it so much. And we were a family business and we brought the family values to the whole business, whether they were family members or not.
You're putting it in the past tense because you have retired, but actually your daughter has just taken over running the business. So the family business does continue.
Absolutely. And I've had the great pleasure of being the recipient of a succession from my father and then being on the other end and passing the business on to my daughter. So I've seen succession and the difficulties of succession from both sides.
Well, let's talk about those because there are many, many, many people who will be listening to this podcast will be interested in that because so many businesses in Ireland are exactly that, family businesses. What are the big issues?
Well, I think we always looked to best practice and maybe we had to because our industry peers and competitors were so strong. So when it came to looking at succession, we knew we needed help. And it's not something that a company does every day. You know, it happens only once a generation. And if you take like a PLC, I think the average life of a CEO is 7 years. If you take a family business, it's often 30 years. So we got help and we went to, that's how I got involved in DCU's National Centre for Family Business. I realised there were courses being run on not only succession, but lots of other governance issues in family business. And I went to a few sessions there and I realized I'm going to get the info I need here. And we engaged with them. And the National Centre for Family Business recommended a firm of consultants, which we eventually used, who was the Cambridge Family Enterprise Group from Boston in the US.
Why go to the US?
Well, the Cambridge Family Business Group have gone through succession with many, many businesses right around the world. And we just felt we were going to get, it was a once-off thing for us. So yeah, it was a little bit, maybe was expensive, but it was, we felt worth it because we only get one shot at this.
Okay. So give me three, let's make it cheap for our podcast listeners, three of their best bits of advice.
I think, firstly, communicate. And succession is often a thing that's done and you feel you don't really need to tell people about it. But it was very important to communicate with all stakeholders. And we ended up getting an awful lot of support where we might have got a lot of resistance without communication.
What is the family set up? You have how many sons, daughters?
I have three daughters. Yeah.
So, and did any of them want to take over particularly?
Well, my eldest daughter was keen to take over the business. And I suppose we were fortunate in that my other two daughters were going in different directions, so weren't keen. So there was no issue.
Phew.
Yeah, it was. we were lucky in that regard. But the other thing, we took advantage of succession, and this was maybe the second tip, to take advantage of succession to restructure. And we beefed up our leadership team. We hired a number of new people in leadership team positions, and we moved our board, where we have a non-executive directors as well. We moved our board to be more advisory.
Why was that?
Well, it is the best practice, and it's very hard for a board of directors if everybody is executive and have executive functions in the business to also see the big picture.
But
you tend to be.
Well, I would have thought that the standard one was executives plus non-executive. No.
Yes, and that's what we have. But
okay.
Our former board of directors was very much more. The majority of the board was executive. Now the majority of the board is not executive.
And the kind of advisory types, you don't have to name them or anything, but what skills do they bring with them that you found? I mean, none of them would be able to mix paint, I'm sure.
No, and it was really important. There's so much paint expertise in our company when you hire non-executive directors. And this was a really good piece of information we got with the Cambridge Family Enterprise Group. The particular skill set that one looks for. And we took a really good broad look at the company. We reckoned we were weak in areas like finance. And one of our non-executive directors is a former partner of PwC, Paul Hennessy. And we were really, really, really very lucky because he also worked in family business when he was part of PwC. So Paul agreed to join our board. A little bit of arm twisting, but we got him there. And we also have Tommy Murray, who's an ex-head of Diageo in the US. So a big corporate, very good operations brain and very good sales and marketing brain as well. So we were able to beef up our board with their skill sets.
But that came, as you say, on succession to your daughter or transfer to your daughter. Prior to that, you have driven the business internationally in a big way. And we mentioned earlier that there are some very, very big competitors. And I often hear people say in business, though, that they welcome competition. You know, the truth is, big businesses love to squash little businesses. How have you survived the squashing?
Yeah, Conal, I'll be really honest here. I've never felt that the big businesses in our industry have been trying to squash us. I think we've done a really good job of being differentiated. And when I did my MBA in 1983, we learned about product differentiation and differentiation of your brand. That then evolved into really taking our brand and looking at our brand values and making sure we were different. So we identified the premium space in the market and nobody was really servicing it. And you could say the multinational brands, they would have one or two brands that are in the premium space, but they were fundamentally in the mass market space. And we looked at premium and we said we could really be the brand that owns the premium space. So yeah, it is about building a better mousetrap. And we make a better paint, but then it's also communicating that. And we were poor marketeers. And I think during my journey, we retained our technical expertise, but we became a better marketing company.
How?
We engaged with consultants on marketing, and we actually put aside marketing budgets that we wouldn't have put put aside before, and we were often challenged by them. They were big numbers, but we did TV advertising, for example, in I think it was 2007 for the first time. We developed an ad that an awful lot of people learned about our brand through our TV ad, where we showed that the origin of our colours is inspired by the colours of Ireland.
And then in 2019, if I'm correctly informed, did you launch your Curator, which is even more upmarket? Is that it?
Yeah, well, that goes back to Colour Trend being our major brand. The way that came about is my dad knew of a colorant company in the US with Colour Trend, and he got their permission to use that as our brand name on paint in Ireland. Little did he realize that that Colour Trend colorant company would go on to become a global company. And so we were under pressure with the Colour Trend name, and we agreed with them that we would just have it for the UK and Ireland. So everywhere else, we're not allowed to use Colour Trend. Ah. And we wanted to export. So we were forced into developing a second brand. We also, though, in our market understanding, identified that there was an opportunity for an Irish designer paint brand. There is no Irish designer paint brand. In the UK, you have very well-known ones like Farrow & Ball and Little Green, or even Paint Library, Laura Ashley. There's about 15 of them, but there was no Irish one. And we wanted to put an Irish one together. So that was the birth of Curator.
Okay. So back sometime during your MBA, you must have learnt a lot about this, about the whole thing about your brand in different markets. Did the penny not drop back then?
Ah, Conal, my MBA was 1984. It's a long time ago. I think the learning from the work experience has been far, far, far more than what you learn in the classroom. I'd nearly love to do the MBA now. I think I'd probably get so much more out of it, having had, 38 years of experience.
You might be able to give the lectures, I hope.
Maybe.
Definitely. So back to Curator. So Curator is your international brand. Now you have gone to UK, obviously, US in a big way. And what I also thought you might have learned from your MBA, trying to ship what is a relatively low-value item in bulk, such as paint. Not a good idea. Or do you manufacture overseas?
Well, currently we manufacture Curator in Selbridge, all of it. And we found a third-party logistics company in, again, Connecticut, your favourite. And so we send over by the container lot. So there's no small amounts going over, and they warehouse and distribute from there.
How many containers a day, a week, a month?
It's been very small so far. So it's, a container a month, but we're looking at bringing it. And when it gets bigger, there's going to be no problem. There's loads of people already contacting us about manufacturing it for us in the US.
Because one of the things that you do, because I saw it with my own little BDs, is that it's all little drips of paint into a base product.
Yes, called tinting.
Okay.
With a tinting machine. Yeah, yeah.
So you obviously have plans for the States, or maybe your daughter now has plans for the States. Would that be fair?
That would be fair, yeah. And rolling back, in 1979, we joined an association in the US called Colour Guild International. And they were family paint businesses from all over the US and Canada. There were 20 or 30 companies who'd gotten together. And we were the first international member. Today, Colour Guild has 50 members from 30 countries. But we were the first international member. And so we got used to associating with other American companies. And we learned an awful lot about the American market. From there, we've joined two other US associations, one on purchasing of raw materials and one on technical. And so we know nearly every paint company in the US very, very well. And in the US, most of the paint companies are also the retailers. They have their own stores. So all of the people who we are selling to are people we've known for many years, who have their own stores, who put in our brand as a designer brand.
Now, this is because of my head lives with this stuff. I go down little rabbit holes. So just a short answer, please. What is the big difference between selling paint in the US and in Ireland? What do the Americans want that we don't want, or we want that they don't want?
It's very similar. There's probably more of a designer element in the US, where they use interior designers more. I think a lot of Irish people are I would say competent, but are comfortable in picking their own colors. Whereas I think a lot of the Americans will, a lot more will use an interior designer to verify their color choice.
So where else after the UK, are you heading into Europe or you are already in Europe?
We're a little bit in Europe, but we're looking at expanding. Our next European market is the Netherlands.
Why there?
It's, if you talk to Enterprise Ireland, they will tell you that an awful lot of Irish companies have success in the Netherlands. The Dutch customer is very predisposed to Irish brands. And so we feel it's a good place to really start in terms of, rather than Germany or France, which are maybe more difficult markets.
Well, I worked for the Dutch in ABN AMRO once upon a time, and as well as being very tall, they're very, very nice people. So maybe they're quite like us. Mm. I would have thought the Germans would have liked that hint of Irish on their walls, no?
Yeah, from my knowledge of the German paint market is that there's a lot of white used, and it's because there's so many homes are rented. And there are a lot of short-term rentals, so they give them a slap of white paint in between rentals.
That is interesting, isn't it? That will you see, do you think you may see, if we go towards the European model of more rental here, are you seeing shifts in the purchasing patterns here?
We're not seeing shifts here, but as there are more rentals, there will be more frequent painting, but probably less use of colour and less use of design.
That's an interesting insight, all right. And what about less use of expensive or quality paint?
It'll be less use of expensive quality paints, that trend. But the trend in Ireland has been very much towards the premium. We were very lucky. And, you know, I think when you're in my position, you look back in your career, you realise you've had a whole pile of luck. But one of the most lucky things we've had is that the market has moved to premium. And you see that in consumers' choice of automobile purchases, everything we buy. People are saying, well, if I buy something a little bit better and higher quality, more expensive, it'll last me longer. And that's happened in paint. The premium market might have been about 10% of the market 20 years ago. We reckon it's 30% of the market today.
I have two final questions, which probably will become five. But one of them is, you've just retired, but you're not really going to retire. You're way too young. What are you going to do?
Well, I'm on a number of board of directors of these associations that we're in. So I'm staying within the industry there. And obviously, I'm working sort of a couple of days a week with General Paints. Also looking to do a little bit of philanthropy and get involved and with giving back a little bit. And I've also got my wife tells me I have way too many hobbies. So
what's the big hobby? Painting.
No, golf and triathlon would be the two big ones.
Oh, good God. Okay, well, moving quickly along from that, the triathlon one, you're hire in a heartbeat. Who would you hire in a heartbeat?
Yeah, I really struggled with this question, Conal. I know other people on the podcast have said the same. For me, though, I think it would be Brian O'Driscoll.
Okay.
And what I like about Brian is how he's handled himself since he's retired. He's been very choosy about what he's done, and he could really have done a lot more, but I think he's been very careful. I really think they're a great couple. They're a great brand, Brian and Amy. And I think he has a lot, obviously very, very, very dedicated guy and reached the top and pinnacle of his career. And that's certainly an ambition we have.
They would be a perfect brand ambassador couple for you, wouldn't they?
That's a great idea, Conal.
And if you put them onto your board, you might get the brand ambassadorship for free.
There you go.
There you go.
Best ideas always on That Great Business Show. Kevin O'Connor, the boss or chairman now of General Paints, or better known still in Ireland as Colour Trend. Thanks so much for joining us on That Great Business Show.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure, Conal.
It's all go, like Chrissy Gno, on thatgreatbusinessshow.com.
We're for a cleaner environment, and that's why we asked Team GBS to consider making just one small change to help achieve that goal. Switching from shaving foam to the world's best shaving oil, Mayo made defactoshave.com, means you will no longer add to the 20 million cans of shaving foam sent to landfills in Ireland every year. A 13-euro bottle of De Facto should last you more than half a year, so it's good for your planet, your pocket, and your skin. Buy it today.
Backing great women-led businesses on every show.
That Great Business Show. When you go onto the ASA marketing website, you find a pretty standard marketing collateral website, selling, you know, the usual branded biros, hand sanitizers, and so on. But when you chat with their Cork-based CEO, Michelle Johnson, you find out that there is a completely different other side to the business. The other side is called Four Fleets. It's a fleet management software system that has some big and tasty contracts with the HSE and the Gardaí, and they are now looking at markets in the UK, Europe and beyond. So nothing whatsoever to do with marketing. And as Team GBS knows, we like intriguing companies like this and the story behind them. And that's why we had to invite Michelle Johnson to that great business show. Tough Fighter Road, Michelle.
Thank you. It's lovely to be here. Thanks for having me.
Your business is too bizarre for words. That's like a leaving cert question. Discuss.
Discuss, exactly. Well, maybe I should just bring you back to how we started. The company was founded by A and Judith, my parents, in the mid-80s. And it, with the marketing background, it was originally set up to help dealerships sell their cars. And so,
because your dad used to work for Ford.
He did, many years ago. He did. And so when we set up, he wasn't long out on his own, actually, when he was asked for some help with marketing and creating a loyalty program for some of the manufacturers for Ford. So we set up a customer loyalty system, and we did mailings and worked with Ford for over 30 years.
Hey, when you say we, you're too young to have been doing it.
Yes, I'm in the business since the mid-90s.
Okay.
Yes. So both sides of the business were running in tandem with each other, and we've always been very involved with databases and database management. That's been a massive side, but it's kind of the quiet side behind the scenes. We were preparing mailings and doing mail chats for clients, but companies may not have known that we were the ones behind it. So that part of it was very interesting. And so our marketing business is the piece where people know us, the promotional branded merchandise, helping clients to promote their brands.
But let's just concentrate on that for a second, because we have to have a long chat about the software business.
Yes.
On the branding side, is that not so 1980s that people just don't do it anymore? In fact, I normally do have a branded biro, so I was going to disprove something to myself. Are people still branding biros and diaries and wallets and sanitizers and...
Yes, it's still a huge business. And what's changed actually for us is the fact that we're dealing with global clients now. So we're part of an international network called IGC Global Promotions, and our partners are based all over the world. There's over 45 of us. And so we collaborate with those global partners on the big multinational accounts. So you could have the headquarters in San Francisco dealing with our American partners, and the brand guidelines and that then are filtered across to us. We look after EMEA. And so, and our Australian partners, Indian partners. So we're all dealing and getting approval from head office on the promotional items that are being sourced and supplied to those companies.
So ASA is covering all of EMEA?
All of EMEA, yes.
That's a nice business.
It's a nice business, yes.
And how many people does that keep going?
Well, I suppose COVID hit us hard. So
well, pre-COVID and post-COVID.
Pre-COVID, we had approximately between both sides of the business close to 20 people.
But on the specifically on your branded buyers?
On the marketing side.
I know, I'm very disparaging about it.
I know, absolutely. It's more, way more than pens. So we have we had about 10 people in that side of the business.
Nice business, isn't it?
Yeah.
And how did you get involved with this international grouping?
Well, we had very high standing with our suppliers, and we were recommended for the position because there's only one member per country.
Does anybody from Cork ever go below a very high standard?
I know. Well, my dad is Dublin and Mayo, and my mom is Waterford.
Oh.
So I'm only just first generation Cork. So really, Cork can't take the credit for that.
That is very good, though. Did you fall on your feet when you got into that?
We did, and it was a bit of a gamble because it was an investment at the time, and we were looking to the future and saying, okay, how can we elevate the business and make sure that we differentiate ourselves from our suppliers? So this has been incredible. So I suppose during COVID, we were able to share insights and information with all of our partners. So at the start, we had to pivot very quickly into what else could we do, because events fell through the floor. So people didn't need merchandise for those. So we collaborated with the partners to find out how could we get branded masks, where could we go to get branded sanitizer. And so we collaborated on where the supplies were coming from and were able to pivot into that side of the business.
So post-COVID, what is going to be the big seller for you? What is big in branding at the moment?
Well, what's big is the individual packs. So instead of having 1,000 items delivered to one address, we have 1,000 items delivered to 1,000 addresses. And so the database part of our business has come into its own again when we're now shipping to individual addresses. So with the hybrid working, we see that continuing. So we're going to have a bit of in the office and a bit of at home. And then I think it's we're really looking forward to getting back where events and conferences will be on board.
Believe me, everybody is.
Everybody is.
Oh, God.
And the other thing I suppose to mention is sustainability, because there's so much talk about sustainability and the importance of it. So the promotional market is following that. And so we're sourcing a lot more sustainable products for people as well.
You know what you should be promoting? De facto shave.
Yes.
I'll get Tom Murphy on to you, because that would be the ideal promotion. So
actually, A knows Tom quite well, and he has been in touch with him over the last couple of months. They were in contact.
I didn't know that, because of course, once you say Mayo, Tom Murphy, boss of De facto, knows absolutely everybody from Mayo and beyond, and everybody in the world. So on to the software side, because this is really intriguing. Explain exactly what you do, say, for the Gardaí.
So effectively, we created a fleet management software system to allow them to manage the maintenance of their vehicles. So we work in tandem with the main manufacturers, and we actually process all of the information to do with the repairs of the vehicle. So if a Garda car goes into a dealership to be repaired, all of the repairs that need to be done to that vehicle are recorded on our system, and they're pre-approved before work starts by Garda HQ. So it has allowed them to cut down on the amount of people that they have working in the organization, because they're processing. We send in one invoice once a week instead of sending out 50 different invoices for all the different jobs from the different dealers.
That probably answers my next question, which is how many cars a week are off? So it's about 50, is it? I'm joking. Anyway, but you've gone way beyond the Gardaí now, haven't you?
We have. We have multiple companies that we're dealing with, and we're looking to grow the business and grow it, I suppose, into other areas as well. We're looking at companies that have a large fleet of vehicles, over 250 vehicles in their fleet, that need to, I suppose, have a manage the costs and the maintenance of those vehicles, so we can help with that. And IT are developing a retail platform where we'll be able to talk directly with customers through the dealers and help them to manage the repairs.
That's very clever. Is anybody else doing this?
There are some competitors globally. There are some competitors.
Damn.
Yeah, but we definitely have a niche. And I think the most important thing for us is we have a very tight team. We have a great team of developers who've been with us since the start, and they're really passionate about the business. So we can adapt and change very quickly. So we are driven then, I suppose, by the customer. And certainly with the existing, the feedback from existing customers is that we're very agile, and that we can, I suppose, take a query from them and we can make instant changes. And that definitely has helped.
So Team GPS, as you know, likes to help people who come onto the podcast. What could we do for you? What are you looking for? You said companies with fleets larger than 250 vehicles. You've obviously done your market research. How many companies like that, say, are there in Ireland?
Well, there are, in terms of, I don't know the exact quantity.
But they're few enough, I'd say.
They're few enough, exactly.
But so in the UK.
It's the UK. Yes, yeah. It's the UK and beyond. And I suppose the UK is our closest neighbour. And with language and everything, it makes sense for us to talk in there.
Have you managed to get your foothold in there?
We're starting some negotiations with companies, but we haven't signed anything as of yet.
What does that mean, really? Do you think, will you be announcing something in a few weeks?
It might be in a few months.
Okay.
But we certainly have Alan, our business development person, has been working extremely hard, and he only started during COVID. So in terms of getting in front of people, we've been using LinkedIn a lot.
How did you find that? Because I am a huge advocate of LinkedIn. I just think we will have people from LinkedIn on the show at some stage.
Yes. They're a big client of ours on the merchandising side as well. But
I don't have a LinkedIn bio.
I could organise one for you.
You probably could organise 10 million of them.
It's been really good, and we did some advertising on LinkedIn and we got some really nice contacts and connections.
We love insights on that, and that's a good insight. And advertising on LinkedIn, because we have done it for the radio show, for the podcast, is it's not expensive.
Yes. It's definitely already, it's paid for itself. And we've only been running it for a couple of months. And just in terms of making connections, and with COVID and the fact that you can't get out and see people and network in a traditional way, I think LinkedIn is really important.
And there are obviously fleets right across Europe and into the US.
Yes.
So let's say that you succeed, and you will, I'm sure, in the UK. What would success look like in the UK for you? Would you like 10 clients, 100 clients, 1,000 clients? Now, obviously, you'd like a million clients, but realistically,
we probably, you know, if we got 5 or 10 clients over there, it would be huge, because the volume of cars that they have, you know, a big fleet here might be 250, but it could be 2,500 over there.
Oh, you dream of that, don't you?
Yeah.
I can see you salivate.
We're dreaming big, and Enterprise Ireland have been a great help. They've given us some help and some funding, and just being able to use the resources. So we've opened an office in London now, so we're all set.
And so that's go there. Mm-hmm. After UK, now obviously there are only so many of you and only so many hours in the day.
Yes.
Where else would you like to go?
Well, we were looking at perhaps Poland and the United Arab Emirates, but there's nothing actually firmed up for there yet.
That's really interesting. Of all of the places in the world, and I know so little about Poland, I've never been to Poland, and I will correct that. Why Poland? Big country, I know.
One of our developers is based over there. He's moved over there, and we have a couple of Polish staff members working with us. So it's...
They're your land bridge in there.
That's it.
And they, it's a big, I think, are there 50 million people there? It's a large company anyway, a large country.
Yes.
It's only 10 times larger than Ireland. Why the United Arab Emirates?
Just, we have some connections over there as well. So it's just exploring those.
And what about my favorite, United States of America?
Yes, and I have been speaking to some people about possibly the States. But we're not at that stage yet. I think we definitely need to have some other international business under our belt before we...
Walk before you can run.
That's it, yeah.
Now, when you wake up in the morning, you've got basically two very different businesses to run.
Yes.
Which gets your attention?
Well, I'm split really between the two of them, but Caroline, my sister, runs the sales director for the merchandising business. So she's really primarily running that business. And I've been dedicating a lot of time to the Forware for fleets during COVID.
A lot of people who've come onto the podcast have said that against all the odds, and obviously COVID has been bad for many, many, but it has given businesses a chance to catch up, to develop, and ready to progress. Would that be you?
Yes, we certainly have developed an awful lot on the marketing for the Forfleet system, and we have a new website up and running, which is fantastic. And it allowed us then to advertise through LinkedIn, because we have really, the website is the foundation. And so for the last 3 or 4 months, we've been working on our ASA website, and we're rebranding in Q3. We have a new logo, slightly new name, and we'll have a new website.
What's the new name?
Well, we're keeping the ASA. Yeah. So, but we're dropping the marketing, because it's been, I suppose, for a long time, we have to explain what we type of marketing we do. So
you can call yourselves ASA Branded Biros, I know.
ASA Brands, actually.
Oh, is it? Okay. Branded Biros.
Because everything we do is brand related. Yes.
And if you have one sister or more in the
sister,
in the business? Are there other family members in the business?
We have one brother, but he is an engineer in the UK, so he's not in the business. But my parents are still involved in the business, so 4 out of 5 is probably enough.
And there's somebody sitting beside me here who could also be in the business very shortly. You have a young son sitting beside me here, Hugh, who is, 13? So he's probably learning as we speak, because that's how you learn in a family business, watching your mum making the big decisions and understanding. I remember my own dad talking to me at length about the things he was involved in. And oddly enough, you just absorb it.
Yes, and he thought he was just coming for a road trip today. So he got more than he bargained for. So thank you for allowing him in.
Oh, he was very, very, very welcome. We're very family friendly here. The final question always is, who would you hire in a heartbeat?
I know, and I spent a lot of time thinking about this.
Everybody says that. Surely, you know, you dream of having a huge business and you'd say, God, if only I had with me.
I know. Well, actually, I've picked somebody local, somebody from Dublin.
Wasn't Cork.
No. And I don't know if you've met Joanne Heshen from the Entrepreneurs Academy. She's definitely somebody you need to have on your podcast.
I did. And I think I may have even interviewed her.
Because she now has a social enterprise called Lift Ireland, where she's empowering people to become great leaders.
And I am definitely connected with her on social media on my Twitter account and on the Team GBS1 Twitter account. But I think that would be a lovely one to have Joanne on the show. And you can say, you got her on.
Yes.
I won't tell her.
I can take credit for that.
Of course you can. And why specifically would you like Joanne working with you?
Well, I've known Joanne for over 10 years.
Ah, she's a pal.
Well, yeah, she is. I suppose at this stage she is, but she is just a really efficient networker. She's just fantastic for people, putting people in connection with other people. And I just admire her. And I feel she's run her own Entrepreneurs Academy business. And now she's giving back to the community and has set up Lift Ireland. And so she's effectively going into businesses and schools, and she's empowering people to understand what leadership is about and breaking it down into the minuscule sections and understanding what it's about. And so the more great leaders we have, the better.
And I also hope that she's helping take out the mythology and all the mystery around being an entrepreneur. Entrepreneur means working for yourself. And
absolutely.
No greater joy. No greater misery as well, of course, but the joy parts are good.
The good days and bad days.
Well, listen, Hugh, thank you very much for joining us. I know you didn't say much, but thank you so much. Michelle Johnson, CEO, ASA Brands. I'm the first person to say it.
Absolutely. You heard
and
it here first.
Four Fleets. Thank you so much for joining us on That Great Business Show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Subscribe today to That Great Business Show on your favorite podcast platform, including Apple and Spotify.
If there is a fashion in how business is conducted, much of the lead comes from big world names like Goldman Sachs and JP Morgan. These hard-boiled firms are unequivocal. Their staff are going back to the office. And if they go back, you can be sure that their service providers, like lawyers, etc., will follow suit. Or if I'm allowed one of my stupid puns, in their suits. In Europe, however, there seems to be a move to a little, and I mean just a little bit more flexibility, as firms this side of the Atlantic are talking more about a hybrid model with a bit of office and a bit of homework. Choices made will affect not just those employees, but also the property values if office buildings aren't going to be fully occupied, investors who try to anticipate demand, and the construction sector that wants to know what's in the future pipeline. Having heard enough ill-informed comments, Team GBS decided to call in the heavy guns, someone whose livelihood depends on actually knowing what's coming down the tracks. Henry J. Lyons Architecture and Interiors is one of the largest architectural practices in the country. And if Managing Director Connor McCabe doesn't know what's going on, well, I guess no one does. Welcome to That Great Business Show, Connor.
Thank you very much.
So what is going on, Connor?
Well, what's going on? I think, first of all, it's worth saying that the office market at the moment is really vibrant. For some context, when the pandemic hit, we probably were designing offices for about 10,000 people. Some of those projects paused. None of them stopped. All of them have continued in some shape or form. All of them have changed in response to the pandemic. And probably in the last 6 to 9 months, we've got a lot of new projects started. So, the death of the office as a phenomenon has been, I think, overplayed.
Greatly exaggerated.
Yes.
Rumors of my death, etc. Now, you said that the projects have changed. What does that mean? Are we going to be, the open office, open plan office is dead and we're going to go into our little booths again?
We're going to go where we need to go to do what we need to do, I think, is probably the answer.
Very mysterious.
So, I think what you mentioned, the example of Goldman Sachs and JP Morgan, we've carried out loads of, the first thing that we probably did post-pandemic and once everybody had absorbed the shock and stopped worrying about plastic screens and circles around desks, was to survey staff and figure out how they felt about working from home and how they would see themselves working in the future. And I think I looked at another one of those surveys this morning, actually.
And these are proprietary to Henry J. Lyons.
Sometimes we use, there are various survey tools out there, specific workplace surveys, and all of those have now grown home modules, so you can compare the work setting with the home. And I haven't yet seen one where the figure for people who intended to be in the office 3 days or less was lower than 80%.
So they are either going back or they want to go back.
Exactly. So they are either staying at home for at least half the time or more. And obviously this is the view of employees. And then the question becomes, well, what does the organization think? But one of the differences, I think, between us and, for example, the JP Morgans and the Goldman Sachs is that our market is really led by technology firms. They are the ones who drive the office market in Ireland. And the pattern that you observe when you look at technology firms is rapid growth. And that's not necessarily the case in, for example, the finance sector. So the balance between the employee and the employer is different. It's kind of an employee's market. Therefore, if the staff say they want to be at home for a certain period of time, you need to listen.
Okay. What about the IFSC, where many of those tech companies are, or they're very close by anyway? IFSC has many, many, many employees. Are they going to go back to the office?
I think, and just to talk about both the IFSC and more generally, I think that what we have found and what we anticipate in projects that have developed far enough that we can kind of form a view on this, is that people will go back to the office. Typically, if you had, say, 1,000 people who were based in a building, on any given day, you could expect about 45 to 50% of them to be in the office. But that's actually not radically different to the number before the pandemic.
That's very interesting. Like, I might be old-fashioned, but I imagine that 100% turnout or less, one or two coughs or something.
No? Almost. Well, so you've got sickness, you've got leave, you've got people traveling, which is a huge factor. You've got, and I think this is a really important point, you have, all this talk about hybrid working and working from home and working in different places. This is not new. You know, this was happening before the pandemic, and it was where we would start on every job. It would be the first question: what's your level of trust with your employees? Does your technology permit you to work at home or in different places? Because what we would find when we walked into a building, and again, this is pre-pandemic, was that a lot of the buildings were full of desks and meeting rooms. And usually the desks were half empty and the meeting rooms were massively overbooked. And so the first thing we would usually say to people is, have you considered rebalancing your workplace so that you only provide the number of desks you need, and then you can increase the things that you're clearly short of?
Okay, well, that makes sense, yeah.
It does, and really...
But sorry, can I go back just on that very point? Who put those desks in the first place and those meeting rooms in the first place? Or was that architects or...?
It was architects, yeah.
Yeah. So they got it wrong.
But I suppose, the norm... Always, I think... Your brief is driven by the relationship between the employer and the employee. And particularly in Dublin, again, where the technology sector has driven growth in the market over the last 10 years. I think because you're competing with other tech companies and you're trying to offer benefits to staff, one of the benefits is seen as being a desk. And, I think personally, and this is just my opinion, this goes back to kind of cubicle culture from the West Coast. When the first tech companies came here, they all had these giant cubicles, and they tended to be companies like Digital and Hewlett Packard and so on and so forth. And I think that some of that engineering culture just carried on into the schemes that we were dealing with up until a couple of years ago. And that barrier was just...
These are the fashions that I'm always interested in, yeah. And then that has died off or died out?
Well, it was beginning, as I said, growth was the the experience for all these companies. And some of them were responding to it by saying, well, actually, let's look at how we're using our desks and how we're using our other spaces and rebalance. And others were just saying, well, can we have smaller desks? And
did anybody ever say, I want a smaller desk?
Oh, we got you.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, I mean, that I can think of several projects where we would have simply taken out all the desks and replaced them with more smaller ones.
There was, I remember the culture back in the BBC, back in the day, where it was all about the size of the desk, whether your chair, and this is all very sad stuff, whether your chairs had arms or whether the color of the carpet was important, and these were all status symbols. Isn't that a sad culture of work?
Yeah, and that wasn't precisely mirrored in these companies, but definitely the desk was getting smaller and smaller and smaller, simply to say, yes, we have a desk for every individual who is assigned to this building.
So the future. What will we expect? Just as we speak, are you being told in terms of our proximity to our fellow workers, will we be 5 meters away or something like that?
I think the sense that we get across our projects, and many of them are for global clients, and they're looking across a whole series of different countries when they make this call, is that, you know, beyond, say, the end of this year, the distancing as a piece of legislation or a piece of health and safety guidance is likely to have relaxed or gone. And so most of the projects that we're now looking at are planning for a post-distancing scenario. That said, I don't think, you know, I was talking about smaller and smaller desks, and you were getting down to sizes of, you know, 1200 millimeter 4 foot desks. I don't think
Does that mean 4 foot square or something?
4 foot long and maybe two and a bit feet deep.
Okay.
We're not going back to that. Nobody wants to sit at a bank of 10 desks where the guy next to you is 3 feet away.
Coughing.
So that, you know, that won't happen. I mean, the change to address your point, I think what we have found over the last 15 months is that there are some things that people do really well at home. And those are the things that they would generally like to continue doing at home. And that there are some things that people cannot do at home. And they're the obvious things, like meeting informally at the edge of a meeting, actual meetings, collaboration. Like, we find this as architects. It's really, really hard in the formative stage of a project when you're trying to throw around ideas. It's just very difficult.
To try to do it on Zoom or something.
Yeah. It just adds so many steps to the process. Whereas if you just get in a room, it takes 20 minutes. So those are the type of things that people want to do together. And then there are still loads of things that, you know, that are better done at home. And so, in short, roughly the same number of people might come to the office, probably slightly fewer, but not massively. But they will do different things. And therefore, the office will change to provide settings for the different things that they need to do.
And the big change will be?
Less desks.
Okay. And smaller.
Bigger, actually. So the desk, you know, the trend of desks getting smaller and smaller and smaller will actually reverse.
Okay.
More meeting rooms, because there are more meetings, as we've all experienced. You know, so that, I think when a lot of people left the office in March of last year, you know, certainly in our company, it wasn't that common to have a video conference. Now we're all living in the land of continuous video conferences. And a lot of offices are not set up for that. And that's not just a question of putting a screen on a wall. It has acoustic impacts. When you add more meeting rooms, as you probably need to, that has ventilation impacts and all sorts of impacts. So, you know, there's a lot of change to reflect that going on. I think people expect that even if half the people are in the office, the other half will still be at home. So you still need the calls. So that's a change. And then you've got all these spaces that allow the kind of informal interaction and the collaboration that doesn't really happen at the desk and often didn't have anywhere to happen at all.
And what will you call those, and what will they look like?
Oh, they will be, could be anything from a kitchen table to a booth to, when I say a booth, I mean a kind of a banquette, like a restaurant, or it could be.
But do they not exist in all the tech companies already?
They exist in some of the tech companies.
Yeah.
But they're And they exist in many offices. But as I say, this is reflective of the fact that many offices were already some way down the road that we're now going down. Maybe the thing that they hadn't done is recognize that their desks were half empty or close to it.
If the employees are going to be, call it what you will, half out, half in or whatever, the bulk of the buildings, are they going to get smaller? Is it going to be, are we going to have smaller buildings?
I think it's going to pretty much net out at being about the same number of square meters per person assigned to the building.
Okay.
So if you had a building previously with 1,000 people, you know, a typical tech company metric, that might be, that was like 150 square foot per people. So that's 150,000 square feet. You still have that same amount of space. It will be laid out differently and there will be less people in it at any given time. So the actual real density on the floor will have dropped.
Yeah.
But the effective density of the building is the same and the requirement is broadly the same.
And maybe, and this is kind of left afield, does this have any effect on decentralization? Will we see larger office buildings going to Athlone, going to Galway, going to Limerick, going to wherever?
I think that definitely we need spaces in cities and towns around the country where people can come and work. And often that's because, you know, for not everybody has a home setting mm-hmm. that is suitable. But I think if you are a large organization, and I'm just looking at through this at the moment through the filter of a large organization, you need to create a culture and an ethos. And I think that's more difficult to do in a whole load of dispersed locations than it is in a single location. I think really that becomes the function of the office is to create a culture and
collaborate.
Collaborate and reinforce a set of values.
And is that just your personal view or is that based on research that you have read?
It's based on research. I think increasingly, and it's based on some of our current projects. You know, the what comes out of the research is the fact that, you know, quite often, even in our own case, a lot of people have joined us since the pandemic. A good chunk of our staff, maybe a third, I think, have never actually been in our office.
Really?
Yes. And it's difficult, therefore, for them to really have a sense of what they're part of.
Okay.
And that's quite common.
But do they miss out on that? That's your next question, because well, if they're working away happily, maybe you just don't need that stuff.
Well, first of all, I think, you know, if you're creative, as we hope we are, then there's the ability to collaborate, which is at the core of what we do. And it's really difficult to do that at the moment. Secondly, I think if you're at the start of your career, for example, you're looking to meet with your peers and the people who are managing you and try and advance your career and learn stuff. And obviously you can't really do that at home or it's very difficult. So there are loads of reasons, I think, why you would want to...
the boss unless the boss is looking at them.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly.
And now you're kind of making much of the tech side. What about your the clients who may be accountants or lawyers? Do they need exactly the same again?
They, first of all, we have clients obviously in all those sectors, and all of them. I mentioned this figure of like 80% wanting 3 days in the office or less. That's pretty consistent in my experience across all those sectors. One thing we are noticing is that there is an increasing divergence between teams and sectors and the type of work that they do. So. And therefore the space and the settings that are needed to support them.
Such as, give me an example, please.
Well, again, to take, say that an example might be, here's one is a bunch of engineers in a tech company and they work very collaboratively. And what they might find themselves doing is coming to a space in an office, which is capable of flipping between, it's an agile space, essentially. It's capable of flipping between desks, a meeting space, a space where you can stand around and brainstorm and put stuff on whiteboards, and that they can book that space for, say, 2 days at the start of the week, do all those things together, and then disperse to their houses and work on tasks that they've identified in the first period of the week.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, to take an extreme other example, auditors in a professional services firm, you know, frequently their pattern, actually that's probably too similar to the first example, so I'm going to think of another consultancy in a professional services firm. They might spend a day or two in a client site and come back and work together in a more conventional activity-based work setting. If you think of a call center, again, these are uses that really people felt at one point could only be done in the office, and increasingly now they're something...
The call center, that's interesting, yeah. So the banks of the kind of the battery hens, that's all gone.
Well, it's been gone for the last 15 months, and now people are figuring out the consequences.
Positive.
Different.
Well, now discuss the difference between positive and or different.
Well, I mean, one of the things I think we would recognize at the moment is that we don't know all the answers. You know,
Never do we?
No. Most of the decisions that we would have made about schemes that we were designing in the last 5 years would have been based on a lot of data and the ability to observe people in their work setting. That's gone. We very few people are really back in the office to any great extent. And we haven't really built up a new bank of data to say, well, this is how people operate now. So what's going on at the moment on most of our projects is a lot of experimentation.
That's really interesting. And, but the office building is will continue. So as they say, rumors of my death are greatly exaggerated.
It continues. The market, there's loads of new work in the market. And as I say, the kind of ratio of square meters of building to individual listed in the headcount is fairly constant right now.
You know what my final question will be, because you have been told. And we always want to know who that you, Conor McCabe, would hire in a heartbeat.
Yeah. So I went through, I considered Jurgen Klopp and discarded that option. I think one of the things that we're finding is really, really important in the design of these new spaces is technology. And so technology to collaborate, technology to manage presence, because I think that the days of just rocking up at the office and expecting a desk to be there, are that's not necessarily going to be the way going forward. Technology to give you information about the safety of the space that you're in. For example, the amount of air changes in this room that we're sitting in now.
Nil.
Nil, indeed. Or the services that are available to you in a building. And then the technology to join all that together so that, for example, you know, AI can anticipate that we've just finished a meeting, we're going to go and get a cup of coffee, I might fire up the coffee machine. And that's something that architects don't do. You know, we're not experts in that field. If you find somebody that can talk really passionately about that field, I think it can be really joined together with design. It's fantastically powerful. And there is a guy called Andrew Emmett in a company called Uncoded in London, who is the best advocate of joined up technology that I've come across in the last few years.
And do you know Andrew?
I do.
And is he Irish with a name like Emmett?
Well, that's a good question. I don't know.
We must link in with Andrew. He sounds really interesting. Maybe he might
be a really good guy for one of your podcasts.
Oh, I would love to have him on. So if you know him that well or at all, do tell him
that we are
Ireland's best business podcast and that you were on it and you were on it first ahead of him. Conor, listen, that's really interesting. At last, somebody who actually knows what they're talking about, because I do, as I say, listen to much of the other stuff and just, you know, it's the end of the world stuff. Never, ever believe that it's the end of the world. Someday it will be, but it's like the clock that has stopped, and it's right twice. Conor McCabe, Managing Director of Henry J. Lyons, thank you so much for joining us on That Great Business Show. And that is it from That Great Business Show, episode 42. As always, my thanks to the team here at Dublin South FM Podcast Studios, Ireland's best podcast studios. Sound engineer Alison O'Dwyer is already checking if she can work remotely from a sunny studio in gorgeous Greece. Meanwhile, her colleague Peter Rice will, later on, make us the sunniest sounding podcast in the world, even in winter. A double gur of mahogat to my Ireland Connecticut Business Council colleague, Cork-based Andy Macken, boss at the Macken Group, who recommended Michelle Johnson to us. And he also linked Kevin O'Connor with us through the EY Entrepreneur of the Year Network. And former Royal Institute of Architects in Ireland President Robin Mandel connected us with Conor McCabe. Buichas to you all. And if you know of a great business that should be featured on Ireland's best business podcast, please don't hesitate. Tell us all about it on our website, thatgreatbusinessshow.com, or via our LinkedIn page, where we have great conversations with past, present and future guests. We are in business, so if you are in business, why not tell others about it by advertising on the only business podcast that does business differently. And finally, my thanks to our sponsor, DeFactoShave.com, the world's best shaving oil. Try it for just 1 week, and like me, you will be a forever convert. So from me, Conall O'Moran, until next week, Slán tomáil.